KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oakland. I'm from East Oakland.
I live on Belvedere Street, two blocks up from Haight.
I'm from the Sunset.
A foggy inner sunset.
Coming up, reports from the ground in Butte County about the aftermath of the Camp Fire.
These trailer parks are reported missing, but with no space numbers, so that's why we got to go through the whole entire trailer park. So we're anticipating that there will be some remains found out there.
Then we'll continue exploring the roots of agribusiness as our reporter travels abroad to Punjab, India.
I tell him it says you should be fully protected when handling the weed killer. He laughs. They say a lot of stuff. They even want us to wear gloves. I tell him maybe you should.
What's being done to keep people safe? Find out today on Cross Currents. It's been nearly a month since the Camp Fire obliterated the town of Paradise. Nearly 14,000 residences destroyed. A lot has happened since then. Families filed claims with insurance companies. Kids returned to school where they could. And emergency crews set to the painstaking task of cleaning up and finding victims. Tess Vigeland reported on that for North State Public Radio in Chico. The former host of Marketplace headed there to do what she could do to help out. And now she leads a nightly show called After Paradise. It's an on-the-ground look at the aftermath. Let's listen to a story from it.
Each day inside a nondescript building at the fairgrounds in Chico, hundreds of people who are involved in the recovery efforts meet for a morning briefing. At the height of the fire, they numbered more than 1,000. Now, there are a few hundred from disaster management agencies across the state and beyond. Police, fire, FEMA, Red Cross, search and rescue volunteers, and crews managing cadaver dogs. For about 5 minutes, they all answer to a roll call.
The National Guard Heavy Equipment Group. And then K-9 team, Eric Sheets. K-9 team, Jeff New.
They're briefed on the weather, on hazards they need to watch out for, and on which part of the disaster site they'll be searching on a given day.
The Alpha teams today will be hitting two trailer parks that will be to priority one. These trailer parks are reported missing, but with no space numbers, so that's why we got to go through the whole entire trailer park. So we're anticipating that there will be some remains found out there.
They're also reminded that the work they're doing, sifting through rubble and ash, can take a toll.
Keep in mind that take your breaks. This is very hard, tedious work. Everything starts to look like bone after a little while. So take your breaks and remember that what the mission is. We need to find these people. So
on Sunday, the mission was to search for those still declared missing who might have perished as the fire roared through. That's been the mission since the fire was declared 100% contained. Dozens of search and recovery volunteers in white hazmat suits and full respirators gathered in a parking lot across the street from the Ponderosa Mobile Estates in Paradise. Placer County Sheriff Sergeant Sage Barassa handed out assignments for the search.
All right, everybody, I want to get you guys out there. I know a lot of these days end up really slow in the morning. It's a lot of briefing, a lot of talking, and everybody wants to get out in the field. So we're still putting together a couple teams. If you haven't come up to me and given me your team list, then you're not going in the field yet. You'll see me after this briefing, but the teams that are on it and gotten that to me.
The volunteers took photos of a map that showed where they would search inside the mobile home park. Then they crossed the street to begin the careful process of searching for bone amid the ash. For the next several hours, they stood beneath a clear blue sky, over the twisted metal of burned-out cars, and aside piles of wreckage that left no trace of the lives that had been lived there. With each piece of property searched, an orange X and the date marked the spot where a search had been conducted. As a stranger on a first visit to Paradise, you can imagine that part of what drew people to this city was the quiet. It's high up on a ridge, away from the busyness of even a small city like Chico. People come to places like Paradise to get that kind of quiet. It's still quiet, but eerily so. Birds evacuated along with everyone else. The only engines now belong to utility and garbage and fire trucks. And the only other sound here among the tall, charred pines on a wide lot that used to be the Ponderosa Mobile Estates is shovels, carefully, methodically scraping through the powdery ash, looking for organic material that shouldn't be there, looking for the missing.
That's Tess Vigeland. She originally reported that story for the show After Paradise out of North State Public Radio. Another voice at that station is Dave Schloem. He hosts a weekly science show called Blue Dot, and he has memories about the town Paradise and thoughts about what might come next.
Everywhere I go in the North State, I overhear the conversations. They usually feature these words: lost everything. The unfortunately named campfire has put the entire area in a state of shock. I'm lucky. I have a roof over my head and a vocation. But my memories of Paradise haunt me because it was my home for many years. I spent my summers in Paradise with family beginning in 1968 before moving there permanently in 1977. I'll never forget the moment I got out of a car after a long drive from LA. It was 2 a.m. and I looked up with my 8-year-old eyes. Set against the silhouette of pines was something I'd never truly seen, a dark night sky and the Milky Way. My summer days were spent fishing the nearby creeks and cutting firewood with my brother. Paradise was beautiful, with majestic old ponderosa pines, lovely flowering dogwoods, and apple orchards. When I first arrived, I think there were 3 stoplights, 2 of them pretty new. The population density was low. It was a mountain town. It was home. My children were born there, my parents passed away there, and my granddaughter was just born there a few weeks ago. The climate was great, too. Real estate agents sold it as a place above the fog and below the snow. That was back when it was foggier in the valley and snowier in the mountains. But that, too, has changed. For many years, I owned a horse in Paradise and used him as a secondary mode of transportation. I remember epic rides down into the canyon of the West Branch of the Feather River, over Sawmill Peak and into Lake Concow, and back. I keep thinking about that since that was the same route the embers of the campfire took decades later. I worked for the local papers, the Ridge Gazette and later the Paradise Post. I was a sports writer there in the early 80s and got to know many of the wonderful educators and coaches at Paradise High School. I had a paper route too, the upper part of Paradise, Magalia, and virtually all of the Upper Ridge. In the past weeks, I haven't been able to get my mind to stop replaying that paper route and all the little homes tucked away in the trees that I know are mostly gone now. As the 80s wore on, I went to CSU Chico and got my degree in geosciences. Paradise was starting to burst at the seams with more and more development. The little apple orchards were mostly gone, replaced by housing and shopping centers. You couldn't really see the Milky Way from town anymore. And of course, there was always talk of what would happen if a fire came to the ridge. Too many people, too few evacuation routes. Lucky for me, I left Paradise and moved to Tehama County, where I teach at Corning High School. A few weeks ago, I was teaching a lesson on the megafires that have devastated California, telling the students that Paradise scared me more than anywhere. We discussed the 4 major causes for these fires: a decade of punishing drought that's dried and stressed the vegetation, the wildland-urban interface, places like Paradise where people want to live in the hills surrounded by forest, more than a century of poorly managed fuels that should have been burned in small fires frequently, and finally, the layer of climate change that some public officials choose to either deny or at best sidestep. But it's a fact that the average year-round temperature in California has increased, a gut punch to drought-stressed plants. There is hopeful talk of rebuilding Paradise, and people will naturally want to return. But should they? And if so, will it be a truly fire-resilient community, or just developed to get folks back into their homes as quickly as possible? These are hard issues to deal with. If a new Paradise rises from the ashes, I hope they plant more apple orchards than shopping centers.
Dave Schloem hosts the weekly science show Blue Dot out of North State Public Radio. That commentary originally aired on the station's new program After Paradise, with daily stories about the recovery. You can find a link to that at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This week, we're looking back at an award-winning documentary series from our newsroom. It's about when agriculture becomes agribusiness and how that's changing farming in California and around the world. Yesterday, we met Sandeep Singh, an almond farmer from Modesto who moved to California from the state of Punjab in northern India. Sandeep's father still farms there, but he can barely make ends meet.
He says, we can hardly make enough money to survive by farming. After the harvest is over, when we're balancing our accounts, we find that we barely have enough left to eat. We aren't able to save money for anything else.
Today, small farmers in Punjab are dealing with the legacy of what's come to be known as the Green Revolution. It started in the 1960s, and it was about increasing food production, high-yielding seeds, pesticides, big machinery. The Green Revolution didn't just change how farmers farm, it changed how they live. KELW's Kavalroop Kaur Singh investigates.
A farm worker squats barefoot on the ground, his toes blackened by soil. He pours weed killer into a plastic bottle and walks over to a flooded field of rice. He bends over and fills the bottle with water. The mixture inside the bottle turns from yellow to a gleaming frothy white. He steps into the rice fields, the water splashes beneath his feet, and the weed killer sprays like a fountain from his hands. I'm standing on my ancestral farmland in a village called Rasulpur in the state of Punjab in northern India. The land belonged to my great-grandfather first, but today no one in my immediate family farms on it. Most of my family lives outside of India. The land is leased to a farmer with no relation to us whose name is Ravinder Singh. The farm worker who sprayed the weed killer while barefoot works for Ravinder. I pick up the weed killer carton to read the label. It's written in English. Ravinder asks me what it says. I tell him it says you should be fully protected when handling the weed killer. He laughs. They say a lot of stuff. They even want us to wear gloves. I tell him maybe you should. It's fine, he replies. We don't have time for that. Ravinder thinks that he and his workers have become immune to the effect of the chemical sprays because they use them so often. He says that his crops need chemicals to grow. He admits they can cause health problems, but they make a tough job a little easier. Farming is the most difficult, he says. You can't rest day or night. It's the hardest work there is. Agriculture is the largest industry in Punjab. 60% of the state's workforce is made up of farmers living in rural villages. The majority are subsistence farmers or family farmers who own less than 10 acres of land. The state of Punjab has a population comparable to the state of New York that lives on half as much land. Ravinder Singh says his children won't be farmers. One of his daughters has already moved to Canada on a student visa. He says there's very little profit in farming these days. The average annual income in Punjab is about 65,000 rupees, which is about $1,000 per year. I ask him if he's ever thought of selling his land. If I sell it, then what else will I do, he asks. We have no other work. Farming is the only means of survival we have. Ravinder says production costs have risen and that he's in debt. In fact, a study conducted by the Punjab Agricultural University found that 9 out of 10 farmers are in debt. The average amount owed is about 6 times the average annual income. So how did Punjab, the land of the five rivers, come to drown in debt? Sukhwinder Puppi is a member of the Association for Democratic Rights, an NGO that has worked closely with farmers in Punjab. He says, to understand debt, you have to go back to the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution brought a banking system with it, he says. Before, when people farmed naturally, they would grow a little cotton, corn, or sugarcane. They wouldn't need much money. It was a natural model of agriculture, but the Green Revolution destroyed the natural model and replaced it with a capitalist one. As farmers produced more crops, they had to buy new technologies. That meant heavier and heavier loans. Sukhwinder says agriculture in Punjab got so tangled up in the banking system that today all of Punjab's debt-ridden farmers are its casualty. But the consequences are far worse than debt. The Punjab Agricultural University estimates that at least 7,000 farmers have committed suicide in the past 15 years. Sukhwinder says the actual total could be triple that. He says that farmers' suicides are reported every day in the newspapers. One day, I opened up a local paper to see that two farmers had committed suicide on that very day in the same district I was reporting in. Karamjeet Kaur is an activist with a farmers' organization called Bharti Kisan Union, or BKU. She lists the names of the dead farmers from her village.
Gurvinder Singh, son of Daleep Singh, Dayal Singh, Mestri, Unnada Pitasi Kaka Singh, Gurpreet Singh.
Karamjeet says that a train runs through her village. In the past few years, she knows at least five farmers who have stepped in front of it to commit suicide. They leave behind families, children, elderly mothers, she says. The lives of their families are filled with suffering. It's unbearable. Karamjeet and I go to a village called Begelere, near a city called Bathinda in rural Punjab. We enter a temple where a group of villagers surround me. Their despair is palpable. One of them is a 45-year-old widow named Kuldeep Kaur. She tells me her husband was a farmer who committed suicide because of debt. My daughter was married, we had little land, so we were in debt, she says. Then my father-in-law died, and my oldest son, he drank chemical spray four times. He was in 10th grade when he died. Kuldeep's body begins to shake as she sobs. The women around us start speaking all at once, encouraging her to stay strong. Kuldeep says there's a great burden on her family. They're still 500,000 rupees in debt, about $8,000. They had to sell their land. The Punjab government created a policy to provide compensation to families of farmers who had committed suicide. But Kuldeep says the government hasn't provided any for her family. When it rains, she says, the roof in our house starts to cave in. We have no means of repairing it. Baramjeet Kaur is an activist representing 28 villages in the women's wing of the Farmers Union, BKU. She says, the Green Revolution has turned the faces of our farmers yellow. It's put us on the path of suicide. But Dr. P.S. Rungi disagrees with that argument. He's a retired professor from the Punjab Agricultural University. He was a consultant to the Punjab State Farmers Commission for about 30 years. He says Punjabi farmers, Punjab scientists, and Punjab's government took the Green Revolution forward. We fixed the food deficit and made the country self-sufficient. Punjab's grain production tripled in the decade after the Green Revolution. Why, then, are so many farmers committing suicide in Punjab? Suicides aren't happening because of agriculture, he says. It's complex. Suicide is in every section.
Do you think the students don't do it? Women don't commit suicide?
Women don't commit suicide, he asks. Is the rate of farmers' suicides more than the rest of society?
Not. It is at par.
But actually, it's not the same. The rate of suicide among Indian farmers is about 50% higher than the national average. The most common way to commit suicide in India is by ingesting pesticides, which suggests farming communities are the ones most affected by suicide. I ask, if agriculture is not the reason for farmer suicide, then what is? The farmers that commit suicide are small farmers who are uneducated, he says. Farming isn't the only reason they do it. A study from Punjab Agricultural University found that the primary reasons for farmers' suicide were poverty and debt. Research conducted by the Agriculture Commission found that 40% of the farmers of Punjab were willing to transition into other sectors, he says, and he thinks they should.
Vocational training, skill training.
We need to provide appropriate vocational training and skills training for farmers, he says. As a country or state progresses, people must leave the agricultural sector and find other work. But the farmers' unions think this is just the government's way to get rid of small farmers. Harinder Kaur Bindu is the president of the women's wing of the local BKU in the cotton-growing Bathinda region of Punjab. They take land from small farmers, construct buildings on it, sell those buildings, and make huge profits, she says. The government wants big farms with big machines, like in California. That's what they dream about. Harinder says that farmers won't give up their land easily. She says, the land is our mother, it's our sustenance, it's worth our life. Harinder and three other women activists from BKU get out of a small car that has two giant megaphones affixed to the top. They've just been traveling from the sprawling city of Bathinda to the small village Begelere on its outskirts. They are here to talk with the villagers about upcoming actions to demand the government help pay back farmers' loans. Harinder is standing on the roof of the village Gurdwara, or Sikh temple, using the temple speakers to call all the farmers, farm workers, and their families to assemble. She has a history of leading successful demonstrations in this village. Several months ago, the state government acquired the land of a village farmer, Jaswant Singh, to build a market. But when Jaswant came to collect his compensation, he was refused by a government worker. After 3 months of pleading, Jaswant committed suicide in the government office and left a note accusing the worker. The BKU Farmers Union demanded the worker's arrest, but the police took no action. So the union organized the villagers and held protests and sit-ins for 8 days. On the 8th day, the police made the arrest. About 50 villagers gather around the temple in the evening light. They are mostly elderly men and women. The men hold green and yellow flags with the BKU logo. It's a white circle with a farmer and his oxen plowing a field at the center, the way farming in Punjab used to look before the Green Revolution. The villagers chant slogans, "Down with the government that keeps our youth unemployed, down with the debt our farmers owe. Don't commit suicide, commit to the struggle." That's a rare message of hope at a time when temperatures rise, farming becomes tougher, and more farmers commit suicide. In Bathinda, Punjab, I'm Kamalroop Kaur Singh for Cross Currents.
That story was made possible in part by the International Center for Journalists. It's the second in a 3-part series that recently won an award for excellence in investigative reporting by the San Francisco Press Club. We'll hear part 3 tomorrow, or you can listen to all 3 parts right now at kalw.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Joanne DeLuna, Angela Johnston, Sarah Nora Coast, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Eli Wertschafter, and Aliyah Yates. Gabe Graben, Tariq Foda, and James Rollins engineer the show. Shirin Adil is our content manager. David Boyer is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.